generally speaking, the first 11 chapters of Romans is what kind of material? It's just doctrinal. It's content, so to speak. And that's generally speaking. But sure enough, in chapter 12, he does turn the corner, and from 12 to the end is what, Keith?
Application.
Thank you. Rough, nonstop application. One after the other after the other. A fellow had a mind to could do a whole message on each one of the applications. Paul's taking a shotgun approach, and man, he's just unloading it all at once. So I'll kind of try to do that. We'll not get too bogged down on any one. Just get the flavor of it. The ESV calls these the marks of a true Christian. And they really are. So as you look at this test, how are you doing? If you really believe all that stuff in Romans 1 through 11, Paul's saying, here's what your life's going to look like. And he lays it out. Some of these things are inconvenient, to say the least. We talked about last paragraph that he arranges these. Some are in singles, some are in couplets, some are in triplets, the way he lays them out. Some help explain the others. So we were in Romans 12, and we didn't quite make it through the paragraph that we were looking at last time. And we made it all the way down through verse 13. So let's pick it up at the end of that paragraph in verse 13. A lot of people at work are pressured to give to the United Way. A lot of bosses want to say they had 100% participation, so it's almost not even voluntary, the kind of pressure they put on you. Well, Paul is pressuring us to give also, but it's not to the United Way. Look who he says to give to in verse 13. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. He had been talking about persecution. For instance, in verse 12, he says, be patient in tribulation. We know that these Christians in the first century were generally persecuted. It'd be like being a Christian today in Iran or China. Sometimes it was okay to be a Christian, and sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes people left you alone, and sometimes they didn't. It was certainly considered an illegal religion. Even though Judaism was accepted by the Romans, Christianity wasn't. Because they said, anything new can't be true. Judaism's old, it's true. Christianity, not so much. So they thought it was their duty as the government to eradicate spurious religions. And so Christianity, at times, had a hard time of it under the Romans. It's easy in the middle of persecution to get self-centered and just worry about how you're going to get by. So first Paul says, well, be patient in tribulation. But then he says, give to the needs of the saints. He's saying, even though you're persecuted, don't forget the other guy. He's got needs too. That's interesting that he broadens your horizon. He reminds you to look out for other people's needs. Now, even though we're not persecuted, it's a fact that Christians still have needs. Jesus said, the poor you always have with you. So I knew, even back in the 60s, when Johnson started that great program to eradicate poverty, that it wasn't going to work. Because the poor, Jesus said, you always have with you. 1 John 3:17, if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? So go back to our verse then, verse 13, contribute to the needs of the saints. That word contribute is a Greek word koinoneo. Sounds like what? You know, koinonia is the verb form of that. We are to be in fellowship with each other. Koinonia. We're to know each other so well, we know when there's a need in the body. And he's saying, be willing to give to help the needs of the saints. Does that make sense? Y'all see that? In our church, we have people who are struggling to find full-time work. There's usually a need there. If you're not working full-time, a lot of times you can't meet all your financial obligations. Some of you guys homeschool. Other people want to send their kids to Christian schools, and sometimes a Christian school will prorate their tuition based on your income, but still, that's a need for a lot of Christian families, is help sending their kids to a Christian school. And of course, all of us pay terrible taxes to support the public schools, but you pay twice if you're a Christian and you want to send your kid to something other than public school. So that's certainly a need that we here in our own fellowship have. You know, seminary can be pretty expensive, and a lot of seminaries will discount the cost of education way below what the actual expenses are. You can give to Christian schools to help for tuition. You can give to seminaries or to seminary students to help offset that. There's an old pastor friend of mine I've known for years, and he's got two sons in Southern Seminary in Louisville. And so I felt the Lord would have me to pay for all their books. So every quarter, they send me the receipt, and I pay for the books. See, you can do things like that, things you believe in to help people. Widows, typically, great loss of income. They have needs, and we need to be sensitive to that. And of course, in the early church, the whole reason they started what we think were deacons in Acts 6 was to help distribute food to the widows. Remember that? So widows, orphans, people that don't have full-time jobs, how can we help? We need to be real sensitive to that. Yes, sir?
A little known, that's a significant savings.
Do y'all hear what he said? If you're 65 or over, I know it's true in DeKalb, he's saying all of Georgia, you can opt out of paying your school board taxes. And if you ever see, every year when I get the county taxes, they seem keen to let me know that most of my money is not going to the county, it's going to the school board. And they have a pie chart of how much going to the school board versus the county, and most of it goes to the school board. You can opt out of that. And as Al said, you could take that money then and give it to a Christian school who's going to use that to offset tuition. Hebrews says, do not neglect to do good and share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. Now, if you look around the rest of the world, if you've traveled very much, apart from Europe, Americans are filthy rich. The poor among us are fabulously wealthy compared to the rest of the world. I didn't look it up before I came here, but I've heard these statistics. If you take percentages of the top people in the world compared to people that don't have money, Americans are like in the top 1%. Most of the world has very little. Paul says to Timothy, the rich, that'd be us, no matter who you are, the rich in this present age are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future. So you know you can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. If you give in this life to help other people, you're storing up treasure in heaven. You might not think you have much money, but let me tell you, you do compared to the rest of the world. When we as a church, you know, we support pretty heavily what God's doing in India and in Sri Lanka, for example. Well, a lot of that money will help the believers in those countries. This is a good thing. This is a way of helping. But ideally, when it's based on relationship, it's even better. That's why we go over there, and that's why I'm trying to get, for instance, Stephen David over here this spring so y'all can meet him, and I hope maybe every night of the week he can be at somebody's house for dinner or maybe for lunch so y'all can get to know him, build relationships, because those guys are working directly with other believers who don't have running water. One house I went into, dirt floor, had brick about this high up, and then they took sticks. It looks like a kid's fort. They lived in it. They took sticks, crooked sticks, and round them up this way, and then they had a thatch roof. No door. You would just hang your clothes on one of the stobs of a branch sticking on the wall. That was it. And then they had a thing just like that next door they cooked in case it caught on fire. It didn't burn the house. That's it. And the guy that lived there had a cell phone. And I said, how do you charge that thing? There's no electricity. Well, he goes into town. He's got a buddy who lives in town, and he goes over there and puts his phone in the cradle at that guy's. Would you like to live like that? Be like camping out all the time for us. That's how they live. Well, anyhow, we can be involved with helping Christians like that. And I don't just mean a handout, but you buy him a scooter so he can get to work, or so he can sell off the scooter. Or one guy, they bought him an oxen because he had a wagon, and he would pull it around and collect wood for people, things like that. So these micro businesses that they have, we can help them. Okay, so those are the needs that saints have around the world that we don't, especially in a persecuted country. You got people in prison for having church in their home or just for being Christian, if you're in North Korea. You've got Christian refugees all over the Middle East. Turmoil, chaos, Arab Springs, all these Christian refugees. Those are some needs there. Voice of the Martyrs is a good place you could give through to help Christians like that. The Southern Baptists are very involved over there, and any money you want to give to their programs for that goes straight to help that. So, guys, here's a flat-out direct command to contribute to the needs of the saints, which means if you're not doing that, you spell that S-I-N. So, I hope you get paid regularly at your job. If you got a paycheck as regularly as you contribute, how would your bank account look? Would you be overdrawn? Your paycheck ought to be a reminder to you, what have I given? Have I given lately? Every time you get a paycheck, you probably ought to write one. What's the next thing he says to do in verse 13? Not only should you contribute, but you should be hospitable, show hospitality. You are to seek to show it. This word seek is a strong word. In the next verse, right down below it, where it says, bless those who persecute you, that's the same Greek word, persecute. You should persecute hospitality. Well, it's a strong word. It means to go after something. The idea of persecuting somebody, you're running them down. And you're after them. Well, you should do that with hospitality. You ought to knock the other guy out of the way to get over there and be hospitable to somebody. See? Isn't that cool? Peter says, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. Now, why would a host grumble over having to show hospitality? It is a lot of work. First thing, most of us would clean our houses up first. I always told Center, I'm glad they're coming. It's going to force us to go down and clean the basement up. We wouldn't have done it otherwise. Most of us would clean up. Now, if you've ever hosted very much, some guests are easier to have than others. I spent weeks refinishing this antique dresser, put down the guest room. And then we had this fellow stay with us, and he got out of the shower with a sopping wet towel, lays it across the dresser. Well, I didn't know he'd done it. I went down the next day. All the wood grain was raised up on. You grumble, okay? People tear things up. We had these people come from another country. They couldn't get over the bugs we have. They lathered themselves up with icky, sticky bug repellent. And they'd go outside for 5 minutes covered in this stinky, icky bug repellent, all greasy. So it's too hot. And then they'd come in and they'd lounge all over the upholstery. Well, you could smear grease all over it. Well, you could grumble. Some people don't lift a finger to help the hostess prepare or to clean up afterward. They just sit there like Regency. Well, you could resent that, like Mary and Martha thing when Jesus was there, you know? I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying, you know how we all are. So there's a lot to grumble about sometimes. He says, no, you should, instead of grumbling, you know it's going to be trouble, inconvenient, but you should persecute, run after chances to be hospitable. So let me ask, when's the last time you had somebody in your home for coffee, for dessert? If you can't think of the last time, you might be failing. No, that's a good start. Let me say, purpose this week, why don't you purpose to have somebody else from church over to your house? That'd be good, wouldn't it? The Greek word here is philoxenia. Phile means, and xenos is stranger. So xenophobia is a fear of stranger. He said you'd have a love of strangers. Philadelphia is a love of brothers, right? These Greek words are made of composite words jammed together. And sometimes they literally mean what the composites are, and sometimes it doesn't really mean what the composites are. It's kind of gotten away from it. So he's not strictly saying, oh, you got to go out of the way, you find a stranger. See, and that's why they just say hospitality. But in that day, the inns weren't safe. And so you got Christian workers coming through. They typically stayed in someone's home. They didn't have church buildings where they have church. Not at Lucky Shoals Park. They had it in people's homes. Have you ever hosted a church meeting? A lot of us have. Some of you haven't. Have you ever hosted a prayer meeting? Have you ever hosted a Bible study? Have you ever hosted a Christian worker that's coming through? Sometimes that would be a stranger. You don't know this guy that's coming. Otherwise, even a businessman would come through town. And you know that idea of they'd go into a city and the elders at the gate a lot of times would offer them a place to stay. They didn't know them because the hotel system wasn't all that great. So in that sense, strangers. But not in that sense. Some of us are too strange to each other. I know some of us are just strange, but we need to get to know each other better. I guarantee you, we don't know each other as well as we could. So back to Al's point, if you're really loving one another, we need to get to know each other, and that involves spending time together. Now, it's easy enough to ask him for coffee and dessert. If you really want to be bold, ask him for dinner. When's the last time somebody spent the night with you who wasn't a family member? Good. But if you can't answer that, well, maybe you should find opportunities to do that. The next time somebody comes through town, we ought to be fighting over who gets to keep people who come to visit. Now, we go to the new paragraph, which is verse 14. All over the world, at this moment, Christians are being persecuted by Islamists, Buddhists, Hindus, communists, dictators, evolutionists, secularists. It says here how to deal with those people when that happens. Verse 14. What are you supposed to do with those who persecute you? Not bless them out. Bless them. What does it mean to bless a persecutor? Treat them as though they were a friend. Wow. The word for bless is the Greek word for good, you, like a eulogy, and the Greek word for talk. In fact, it's eulogeo. We get a word eulogy. You know, a dead person, you never talk bad about the dead, right? Have you ever been to a funeral where a guy was, he was into everything but a coffin, and he finally got in the coffin? The preacher talks about him, you go, is that the same guy I knew? Because they make him sound like saints. You speak good about these persecutors. You treat him like a friend in that sense. There's this true story of an Anabaptist. You know, they were persecuted by the European governments because it wasn't part of the state religion. And whether they were Catholic or Protestant governments, they still didn't like the Anabaptists. They saw them as anarchists. And some of them were because of the Munster thing. But anyway, not all of them were. And this one Anabaptist was running for his life from the policeman. And he was going across a frozen lake. He got away and onto the other side, and the policeman fell through and was at the verge of drowning. And this Anabaptist went back on that ice and pulled out the policeman and saved him, even though that same guy, his purpose was to arrest him and execute him. That's an example of that. Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same?" You remember when Stephen was being stoned, it says, falling to his knees, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." And when he said this, he fell asleep. Paul was there to see that. And Stephen's attitude, no doubt, played some role in Paul's conversion. And St. Augustine said, quote, "The church owes Paul to the prayer of Stephen." That's probably true. Now tell me one more time how you're not supposed to respond to persecution, according to verse 14. Yeah, so how easy it would be to curse back. He says, don't do it. I imagine Jesus thought it inconvenient to have to die on the cross for our sins. You think, couldn't God have done that some other way? But that's what it took. And in that same way, now, God's working in the lives of the elect. I don't know who those people are. You don't either. But part of that process, there's a process involved in bringing the elect to salvation. He doesn't just sprinkle pixie dust on them. He causes somebody to share the gospel with them. That's one thing. Oh yeah, we should be witnesses. But another thing is, he causes some of those elect people before they're saved, who persecute Christians, see how they respond to persecution. See what you're really made of. And that witness, God can use to cause some people to come to salvation. And you think, couldn't he have thought some other way to do that? But that's the way it is. So you never know. When somebody mistreats you, now the context seems to be here because you're a Christian. But even if not because you're a Christian, even because of, like in Rusty's example, when somebody mistreats you and they see how you respond, God can use that as a powerful witness. Words are cheap. But what's down in the well comes up in the bucket. Or when you shake the salt shaker, what comes out? Well, hope salt comes out. So people are watching. So you don't know what God's doing. He'll use it in your life to make you more like Jesus. He might be using it in other people's life to make them more like Jesus. Don't know. Your response to evil has got to be premeditated. We talk about premeditated murder versus just not premeditated murder. It makes a big difference in sentencing. Well, you've got to have a premeditated response to evil. Because you can't respond naturally. You got to respond supernaturally. So just like Dwayne said, the power's on your side. You got to respond in love, not in retaliation and cursing and all the things the world would do. So premeditate it. It's going to happen. Decide now how you're going to respond. This is what he's telling us to do. Peter said, "Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you might follow his steps. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So, you know, a little test is, and I think we're all probably guilty of this, you know, it's a busy mall and you're looking for a parking space and you see one and nobody's around and it's yours and you're going to it and you're there. All of a sudden, somebody out of nowhere zooms in there and gets your spot. How do you respond to that? Or you're doing something in traffic and some jerk puts his finger out the window and makes an obscene gesture. How do you respond to that? How do you feel about that, you see? Or somebody cuts in line ahead of you. We all know what our first reaction is, which is why I carry blanks in my gun. When I pull it out and start shooting, at least I know it's not going to hurt him. It's scare him real good. Booker T. Washington, neat guy, I believe he's a Christian, he said, "I will not allow any man to make me lower myself by hating him." So, verse 14. This is so important, he says it twice. You see that? Bless those who persecute you. Bless, twice, and curse not. You start with not cursing them. That's a good start right there. If you can't do anything else, just be quiet. All right, then. The next verse, tell me the idea behind this verse, verse 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. What's the idea behind that?
Loving one another.
And why is that loving one another?
Because, for instance, if a family member is going to be sensitive, aware of...
Take an interest in to find out. Okay.
Members.
Yes, sir.
I think it's the idea of trying to enter into someone.
Be glad for them.
Be glad for them.
Good.
And the same thing with someone's weeping about it.
Have you ever, when your kids were little, some small thing happened, and it's the end of the world, and your child is having a meltdown. It ain't no big deal. But it's a big deal to him. He doesn't know any better. And so you comfort the child. You know, oh, suck it up. No, you. Well, some of you might. But you comfort the child because it's important to the child, right? And this is the same thing. Now, Craig.
Well, the key word there, I think, is with. Mm. And that the indication there, I think, is to...
Yeah, you're with them.
Not just when something good happens to them, something bad happens to them.
Yeah, a basis for relationship there. Yeah. Some of us, I'm afraid, have the spiritual sensitivity of a sledgehammer. You got to put the sledgehammer down. Okay? Be sensitive to other people. And that, again, presupposes we know each other, as Craig said. Now, which is harder to do? Is it harder to rejoice with those who rejoice, or is it harder to weep with those who weep? You think weeping's harder? I appreciate that. Chrysostom was the bishop of Constantinople. You've seen that big mosque in Istanbul? It's a huge round dome thing with the four minarets around it. Well, that used to be a church. What's it called? St. Sophia? Hagia Sophia? Well, that was built after him. That's the city he was in right there. And so he was writing about this. And like Dwayne said, it depends on your maturity level. If you're immature, it's going to be harder to, to rejoice than to weep. He said, "It requires more of a high Christian temper to rejoice with them that do rejoice. It requires a very noble soul so as not only to keep from envying, but to feel pleasure with the person." So if you got two people got sickness and God heals one and not the other, the sick guy is supposed to rejoice with the one that's healed, even though he'd be tempted to say, "Well, God heal me," you know. And we still, we rejoice. That's it. So what we're dealing with here is sympathy. There's symphony, you're all together in the same sound. Sympathy, you're all in the same feelings. Okay, the opposite of sympathy is apathy. You don't have any feelings. So to be stoic and not care about other people and not feel what they're feeling is, well, it's, of course, it's a sin. It's really, you're announcing to the world, you're not very spiritually minded and you don't have a very close walk with Jesus. That's what that transmits. That's what it comes down to. Because you're going to care about other people if you're in tune with Jesus. Speaking of being sensitive, I thought of this proverb. It says, "Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, will be counted as cursing." Yeah. Sometimes I'm not very sensitive to Matthew, and when I felt like he's been in bed long enough, I burst into his room with an explosion of morningness. And, you know, if I was sensitive, Sandra has appealed that perhaps I shouldn't do that. And so perhaps not. But that proverb is showing if you're sensitive to your neighbor, you know most people don't like loud noises early in the morning. Like Nathan. At night, you can't shut him up. I'm ready to go to bed. It's 1 a.m. He's going, okay. But in the morning when he gets up, there ain't no talking to him. Most people count a loud greeting as a curse in the morning. So if you're sensitive to other people, you don't do that. But it's true of this weeping and rejoicing thing in general, right? Well, let's do one more, maybe. Okay, where are we? That was verse 15. Verse 16, we have a triplet, and these kind of go together. He says, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Actually, that's not a triplet. That's a quadruple, I get, isn't it? So, again, in music, if you're in harmony, like if you tune all the instruments to the same tuning fork, they'll be in tune with each other. Well, we're to be in tune with Jesus. If you're in tune with Jesus, guess what? We're going to be in tune with each other. So this idea of being in harmony with somebody is that thing. Literally, it says in the Greek, it says, be of the same mind to one another. So the New American Standard translates this just that way. Be of the same mind toward one another. Paul wrote to two women, Euodia and Syntyche. He says, I entreat these two women to agree in the Lord. And then in Philippians 2:2, it says, complete my joy by being of the same mind. And even talking about Christians disagreeing with each other in business, Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 6, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat. Look at this. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? Let it go, he's saying. That's pretty tough. They talk about among Christians. We're to be of the same mind toward one another. We're treating everybody equally. That means you're not a respecter of persons. There shouldn't be any kind of a caste system in the church. And in the early church, that was the only institution where master and slave would sit next to one another in church as equals. It didn't happen anywhere else. James says, show no partiality as you hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. If a man wearing a gold ring and fine clothes comes into your assembly, and a poor man in shabby clothing also comes in, and if you pay attention to the one who wears the fine clothing and say, you sit here in a good place, while you say to the poor man, you stand over there, or sit down at my feet on my footstool, have you not then made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? If you show partiality, you are committing sin. Translate that for us. If you're looking at visitors at church and somebody drives up, a new guy, he's in a Mercedes, and then somebody else drives up an old beat-up jalopy, and they both drive up at the same time, and you can only be with one of them, and you pick the rich guy to be nice to because of what he drove up in, you've sinned. That's what he's saying. And this isn't a house church context. Really, what it says in the Greek is the rich guy comes in, you give him a nice chair, but that kind of assumes we're tied on space, and we're out of chairs. The only place left is a footstool, and you put the poor guy on the footstool because one has money and the other doesn't. He says, you've sinned. Watch your motives. Shouldn't be that way. And then he goes on to say, don't be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. So you can see how all these things would tie together. The Greek word for haughty means up high, putting on airs, and you're airy. That's the idea, you're up there. Martin Luther said, this word is addressed to those who are conceited, stubborn, and obstinate, persons who accept no advice, even though they have been convinced by every argument of reason. They are the cause of dissensions, the most vicious peace breakers and destroyers of the unity of the faith. So, how do you live in harmony with one another? Well, one is you don't be high-minded. You don't put on airs. You don't be haughty. Instead, he says, associate with the lowly. Now, you notice the word lowly. The lowly what? We don't say. It could be lowly people, but it could be lowly tasks. I'd be nothing you're not willing to do in the church. Clean the bathroom. Jesus said, wash one another's feet. Well, that was a lowly job, wasn't it? In the Salvation Army years ago, they used to make the head guys polish everybody else's shoes. This is all an attitude thing, and if we all did this in the church, what kind of church would it be? What would our church be like if all of us lived out verse 16? It would be good, wouldn't it? He pairs being associated with the lowly, with not being haughty. And then he says, the last thing he says is, never be a wise guy. Never be wise in your own sight. Proverbs says that. 3:7, don't be wise in your own eyes. Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. All that goes together. That's all part of living this out. Attitude stuff. How should you view your possessions in light of the needs of other believers? You are a steward. That's right. They're given to you by God for His purposes. That's good. And why do you need to have a premeditated response to those who harm you?
Because our flesh, we automatically...
In your flesh, you're going to emote bad things out. I was talking to Craig the other day at lunch about safety training with a gun. You train with a gun, and you train, and you train, and you train, so that in a stressful or emergency situation, you don't fumble and bumble. You know what to do. It's part of you. And this is, you need to train this so you do what God wants you to do, not the flesh. Next week, we're going to talk about revenge and why you should never avenge yourself.
This message was produced by the New Testament Reformation Fellowship, ntrf.org. Reforming today's church with New Testament church practice. God bless you as you seek to follow Him in obedience. May your faith in the Lord Jesus be strengthened and your daily walk with Him deepen.